short work of the dead. Such was the drift of the dire report that gallant man delivered. He got little wrong in what he told and predicted. The whole troop rose in tears, then took their way to the uncanny scene under Erneness. There on the sand, where his soul had left him, they found him at rest, their ring-giver from days gone by. The great man had breathed his last. Beowulf the king had indeed met with a marvelous death. But what they saw first was far stranger. The serpent on the ground, gruesome and vile, lying facing him. The fire dragon was scarcely burnt, scorched all colors. From head to tail, his entire length was 50 feet. He had shimmered forth on the night air once, then winged back down to his den. But death owned him now. He would never enter his earth gallery again. Beside him stood pitchers and piled-up dishes, silent flagons, precious swords eaten through with rust, ranged as they had been while they waited their 1,000 winters underground. That huge cache, gold inherited from an ancient race, was under a spell, which meant no one was ever permitted to enter the ring hall unless God himself, mankind's keeper, true king of triumphs, allowed some person pleasing to him, and in his eyes worthy, to open the hoard. What came about brought to nothing the hopes of the one who had wrongly hidden riches under the rock face. First the dragon slew that man among men, who in turn made fierce amends and settled the feud. Famous for his deeds, a warrior may be, but it remains a mystery where his life will end, when he may no longer dwell in the mead hall among his own. So it was with Beowulf, when he faced the cruelty and cunning of the mound guard. He himself was ignorant of how his departure from the world would happen. The high-born chiefs who had buried the treasure declared it until doomsday so accursed that whoever robbed it would be guilty of wrong and grimly punished for their transgression, hasped in hell bonds and heathen shrines. Yet Beowulf's gaze at the gold treasure when he first saw it had not been selfish. Wiglaf, son of Wecstan, spoke. "Often, when one man follows his own will, many are hurt. This happened to us. Nothing we advised could ever convince the prince we loved, our land's guardian, not to vex the custodian of the gold. Let him lie where he was long accustomed, lurk there under earth until the end of the world. He held to his high destiny. The hoard is laid bare, but at a grave cost. It was too cruel a fate that forced the king to that encounter. I have been inside and seen everything amassed in the vault. I managed to enter, although no great welcome awaited me under the earth wall. I quickly gathered up a huge pile of the priceless treasures, hand-picked from the hoard, and carried them here where the king could see them. He was still himself, alive, aware, and in spite of his weakness, he had many requests. He wanted me to greet you, and order the building of a barrow that would crown the site of his spire, serve as his memorial, in a commanding position, since of all men to have lived and thrived and lorded it on earth, his worth and due as a warrior were the greatest. Now let us again go quickly, and feast our eyes on that amazing fortune heaped under the wall. I will show the way and take you close to those coffers packed with rings and bars of gold. Let a bier be made and got ready quickly when we come out, and then let us bring the body of our lord, the man we loved, to where he will lodge for a long time in the care of the Almighty. Then Wechstan's son, stalwart to the end, had orders given to owners of dwellings, many people of importance in the land, to fetch wood from far and wide for the good man's pyre. "Now shall flame consume our leader in battle. The blaze darken round him who stood his ground in the steel hail when the arrow storm shot from bowstrings pelted the shield wall. The shaft hit home. Feather-fledged, it finned the barb in flight." Next, the wise son of Wechstan called from among the king's thanes a group of seven. He selected the best and entered with them, the eighth of their number, under the god-cursed roof. One raised a lighted torch and led the way. No lots were cast for who should loot the hoard, for it was obvious to them that every bit of it lay unprotected within the vault, there for the taking. It was no trouble to hurry to work and haul out the priceless store. They pitched the dragon over the clifftop. Let tides flow and backwash take the treasure minder. Then coiled gold was loaded on a cart in great abundance, and the gray-haired leader, the prince on his bier, born to Ronusness. The Geat people built a pyre for Beowulf, stacked and decked it until it stood four square, hung with helmets, heavy war shields, and shining armor, just as he had ordered. Then his warriors laid him in the middle of it, mourning a lord far famed and beloved. On a height they kindled the hugest of all funeral fires. Fumes of wood smoke billowed darkly up. The blaze roared and drowned out their weeping. Wind died down and flames wrought havoc in the hot bone house, burning it to the core. They were disconsolate and wailed aloud for their lord's decease. A Geat woman, too, sang out in grief. With hair bound up, she unburdened herself of her worst fears, a wild litany of nightmare and lament. Her nation invaded, enemies on the rampage, bodies in piles, slavery and abasement. Heaven swallowed the smoke. Then the Geat people began to construct a mound on a headland, high and imposing, a marker that sailors could see from far away. And in 10 days they had done the work. It was their hero's memorial. What remained from the fire they housed inside it, behind a wall as worthy of him as their workmanship could make it. And they buried torques in the barrow, and jewels, and a trove of such things as trespassing men had once dared to drag from the hoard. They let the ground keep that ancestral treasure, gold under gravel, gone to earth, as useless to men now as it ever was. Then 12 warriors rode around the tomb, chieftains, sons, champions in battle, all of them distraught, chanting in dirges, mourning his loss as a man and a king. They extolled his heroic nature and exploits, and gave thanks for his greatness, which was the proper thing, for a man should praise a prince whom he holds dear and cherish his memory when that moment comes when he has to be convoyed from his bodily home. So the Geat people, his hearth companions, sorrowed for the lord who had been laid low. They said that of all the kings upon the earth, he was the man most gracious and fair-minded, kindest to his people, and keenest to win fame.
The End. You've been listening to Beowulf, a new verse translation by Seamus Heaney, narrated by George Guidel. And now, an essay by Seamus Heaney concerning Beowulf, and particularly the work of its translation. Seamus Heaney is one of the most acclaimed poets writing in English today. Born and raised in Northern Ireland of Roman Catholic parents, he was educated at Queen's University Belfast, where he studied English literature. He has always been involved in education, working first as a secondary school teacher and later, as his renown as a poet grew, a visiting professor at Harvard University. He held the Oxford Professorship of Poetry from 1989 to 1994. In 1995, he was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. A resident of Dublin since 1976, today he divides his time between Dublin and Harvard. What follows is an essay by Seamus Heaney concerning Beowulf and particularly the work of its translation. And now this is an inheritance. Upright, rudimentary, unshiftably planked in the long ago, yet willable forward, again, and again, and again. Beowulf, the poem. The poem called Beowulf was composed sometime between the middle of the 7th and the end of the 10th century of the first millennium, in the language that is today called Anglo-Saxon, or Old English. It is a heroic narrative, more than 3,000 lines long, concerning the deeds of a Scandinavian prince, also called Beowulf, and it stands as one of the foundation works of poetry in English. The fact that the English language has changed so much in the last 1,000 years means, however, that the poem is now generally read in translation, and mostly in English courses at schools and universities. This has contributed to the impression that it was written, as Ossip Mandelstam has said of the Divine Comedy, on official paper, which is unfortunate, since what we are dealing with is a work of the greatest imaginative vitality, a masterpiece where the structuring of the tale is as elaborate as the beautiful contrivances of its language. Its narrative elements may belong to a previous age, but as a work of art, it lives in its own continuous present, equal to our knowledge of reality in the present time. The poem was written in England, but the events it describes are set in Scandinavia, in a once upon a time that is partly historical. Its hero, Beowulf, is the biggest presence among the warriors in the land of the Geats, a territory situated in what is now southern Sweden. And early in the poem, Beowulf crosses the sea to the land of the Danes in order to clear their country of a man-eating monster called Grendel. From this expedition, which involves him in a second contest with Grendel's mother, he returns in triumph and eventually rules for 50 years as king of his homeland. Then a dragon begins to terrorize the countryside, and Beowulf must confront it. In a final climactic encounter, he does manage to slay the dragon, but he also meets his own death and enters the legends of his people as a warrior of high renown. We know about the poem more or less by chance, because it exists in one manuscript only. This unique copy, now in the British Library, barely survived a fire in the 18th century, and was then transcribed and titled, retranscribed and edited, translated and adapted, interpreted and reinterpreted, until it has become canonical. For decades, it has been a set book on English syllabuses at university level all over the world. The fact that many English departments require it to be studied in the original continues to generate resistance, most notably at Oxford University, where the pros and cons of the inclusion of part of it as a compulsory element in the English course have been debated regularly in recent years. For generations of undergraduates, academic study of the poem was often just a matter of construing the meaning, getting a grip on the grammar and vocabulary of Anglo-Saxon, and being able to recognize, translate, and comment upon random extracts which were presented in the examinations. For generations of scholars, too, the interest had been textual and philological. Then there developed a body of research into analogues and sources, a quest for stories and episodes in the folklore and legends of the Nordic peoples, which would parallel or foreshadow episodes in Beowulf. Scholars were also preoccupied with fixing the exact time and place of the poem's composition, paying minute attention to linguistic, stylistic, and scribal details. More generally, they tried to establish the history and genealogy of the dynasties of Swedes and Geats and Danes to which the poet makes constant allusion, and they devoted themselves to a consideration of the worldview behind the poem, asking to what extent, if at all, the newly Christian understanding of the world, which operates in the poet's designing mind, displaces him from his imaginative at-homeness in the world of his poem, a pagan Germanic society, governed by a heroic code of honour, one where the attainment of a name for warrior prowess among the living overwhelms any concern about the soul's destiny in the afterlife. However, when it comes to considering Beowulf as a work of literature, there is one publication that stands out. In 1936, the Oxford scholar and teacher J.R.R. Tolkien published an epoch-making paper entitled Beowulf, the Monsters and the Critics, which took for granted the poem's integrity and distinction as a work of art and proceeded to show in what this integrity and distinction inhered. He assumed that the poet had felt his way through the inherited material, the fabulous elements and the traditional accounts of an heroic past, and by a combination of creative intuition and conscious structuring, had arrived at a unity of effect and a balanced order. He assumed, in other words, that the Beowulf poet was an imaginative writer, rather than some kind of back formation derived from 19th century folklore and philology. Tolkien's brilliant literary treatment changed the way the poem was valued and initiated a new era and new terms of appreciation. It is impossible to attain a full understanding and estimate of Beowulf without recourse to this immense body of commentary and elucidation. Nevertheless, readers coming to the poem for the first time are likely to be as delighted as they are discomfited by the strangeness of the names and the immediate lack of known reference points. An English speaker new to the Iliad, or the Odyssey, or the Aeneid will probably at least have heard of Troy and Helen, or of Penelope and the Cyclops, or of Dido and the Golden Bough. These epics may be in Greek and Latin, yet the classical heritage has entered the cultural memory enshrined in English so thoroughly that their worlds are more familiar than that of the first native epic, even though it was composed centuries after them. Achilles rings a bell, but not Scyld Scaphing. Ithaca leads the mind in a certain direction, but not Heorot. The Sibyl of Cumae will stir certain associations, but not Bad Queen Mothrith. First-time readers of Beowulf very quickly rediscover the meaning of the term, the Dark Ages. Still, in spite of the sensation of being caught between a shield wall of opaque references and a word hoard that is old and strange, such readers are also bound to feel a certain shock of the new. This is because the poem possesses a mythic potency. Like Scyld Scaphson, as Scyld Scaphing is known in this translation, it arrives from somewhere beyond the known bourne of our experience, and having fulfilled its purpose, again, like Scyld, it passes once more into the beyond. In the intervening time, the poet conjures up a work as remote as Scyld's funeral boat borne towards the horizon, as commanding as the horn-pronged gables of King Hrothgar's hall.